This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have really the great pleasure of talking to Anne Enright about her newest book called The Green Road. Anne is pretty well known, I think, as a Man Booker Award winner for The Gathering from 2007, and I think most recently was named the first Irish fiction laureate. I don't even know what that is, but congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Apparently I am the public face of Irish fiction for 3 years, after which some other face was substituted.
And that means we're honored to have you here in America.
In a diplomatic sense, yes. But
yes.
I wouldn't, yeah.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. And I love the book. It's complicated and there's a lot to talk about. I also have asked you to read from the book. Now, we didn't really talk about at what point during our conversation you'll read. So we'll just hopefully find a time that it will work, because I think hearing your prose will be really interesting and powerful. So, you know, I really don't want to give away storylines. So we'll just maybe talk about the structure and how the book is formed. But before we do that, I'd love for you to talk just a little bit about how you came to be a writer. I know you started out doing other things. You worked in theater and television.
I did, yeah. But I was kind of writing all along, I suppose. Or, I mean, when you look at your life, you think it's always destined that there could have been nothing else. But and there probably wasn't. I would have defaulted to writing at any given stage. I worked in the theater when I was a student. And for a year after I left college, I acted. I won't even use inverted commas. I did. I was on the stage. And then I got offered a writing job, and I took it for a thing that didn't pan out. But and after that, I went to do an MA in creative writing in East Anglia, in the University of East Anglia. After which, I got a job by accident, and I spent 6 years in TV production. But all the time I was working on, I mean, it's very seductive, all that media stuff, and it's very busy and very antsy, and you get filled with most bizarre ambitions. You know, you think, God, if I'm really lucky, I'll get to run that quiz show, you know.
There's something to aspire to.
And it's quite, and everyone who works in the media thinks that what they're doing is really very important. And I'm sure it is, actually, especially in a small country like Ireland, where I was in the national broadcasting station. Anyway, all of that, I'd go home on Friday night and I'd write all weekend. So I wasn't letting it go. And I produced a book after maybe three or four years. And when I saw the book, I kind of realized that's what I'm for, really.
But you started writing short fiction, short stories?
I did. Well, I was short stories as much as I could keep in my head over the course of a weekend. Yeah. And so short fiction was my way in, and also my way out of TV.
So I read this article or piece that you wrote in The Guardian, British newspaper, which does more thoughtful journalism probably than we see here. And I don't mean to insult the U.S. journalism institutions, but I never see pieces like you wrote here. And I thought it was really interesting, because you were talking about the writing of this book, The Green Road, where you went to the western part of Ireland, and it's places that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, I was writing in that essay. I was saying I wasn't all that keen, or hadn't been all that keen, on the landscape solution in Irish prose, where an Irish writer just throws a bog in, you know, or says the word Atlantic, and all this yearning churns around in the prose.
Because
and
it's
something.
Signifying.
It's signifying, yeah. So I was talking about how the fringes of the west coast of Ireland, those rocky, barren outcrops, the last place before America, how they became the locus for a kind of loss, nostalgia, lost innocence, a kind of yearning. It's the place people want to go home to. But it was also where the Irish National Revival, where Yeats and Lady Gregory went to admire the peasants and the wonderful peasants with their wonderful stories, which were all about fairies and leprechauns. I mean, not quite leprechauns, but what became leprechauns.
Trying to restore the Celtic
Yeah.
The original Celtic tradition.
And the Celtic Twilight, as it was called, which was a high lyrical, transcendental, slightly anti-Catholic reach.
Very romantic.
Very highly, beyond romantic, transcendental. And then Singh, who wrote Playboy of the Western World and Riders to the Sea, came along. And he was interested in the personality of these people, not in their stories. Anyway, this was the beginning of it all. This was the beginning of the Irish state. This was the beginning of a sense of ourselves as poor but noble or poor but lovely. So all of that was strenuously avoided all that. I didn't think poverty made me any more lovely than a bit of money. I thought that might help me actually be a little more lovely. And I was, you know, very wary of all these myths about the West. And actually, when I thought about it, the West was where my father grew up and where I spent all my summer holidays. So we took a long rent on a little house in County Clare. And I walked up this place called the Green Road, which is a grassy road up above the Atlantic, It really exists.
See, I couldn't figure
it
that
out
from
out,
the
book. Yeah, okay. Over the yeah. Aran Islands and yeah. North to Galway Bay. It's the most beautiful. It is, as a child in the book says, it is the most beautiful place in the world, bar none. And I just thought, I know this place has been so written and written again. It's like papier-mâché, you know, there's so many layers and accretions of texts in this landscape. But actually, here I am, here's the sky, here are the stones under my feet. I might as well own it as anyone else, you know. So I set the book in County Clare.
But it is what I noticeably not sentimental, I thought.
Yeah.
In fact, you resisted the sentimentality quite a lot. Although I did, the one thing that I know I'm kind of going out of order from the book itself, but the character, the book is about an Irish family,
mm-hmm.
and with four children and the mother who's really kind of at the heart of the story. And a lot of this book is about the relationships of mothers and children, which will be very familiar. You don't have to be Irish to have these relationships. Very familiar to, I think, a lot of people, the conflicted feelings about the mothers and some of the things that you wrote about the mother herself being loving and hating and angry and thwarted. And you never really get to know her directly in the book, which I thought was really interesting.
I don't think Rosaline really knows herself very well. I mean, mothers are never easy, even if they're nice, because the mother is the person you separate from first. So that separation is going to be in some way complex, no matter what the personalities involved, the personality of the child or the personality of the mother. It's made more complex in this book by Rosaline's. She's a difficulty to herself and to her children. So I say the book is about compassion, but the challenges to the children's compassion and sense of connection or aloneness. It's about exile and return. It's all about, yes, it is all about the mother. Yeah.
Right. And they have to, now all, and noticeably, all four of the children leave,
mm-hmm.
which uh-huh. I think is maybe, I mean, that's part of her problem and part of their problem. Their solution, maybe.
Your children leave. That's what your children do.
Yeah.
They're leaving you from the minute they're born. That's when it all begins. And it doesn't stop. I mean, Rosaline constantly feels herself to be abandoned. But, you know, that's called growing up and moving away. Also, it has to be said that going away was what Irish people did in the 80s.
Well, I was thinking,
were no jobs in Ireland,
right.
So you went, you know.
There's a tradition of Irish people leaving.
Yes.
More so than maybe other places.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you have the four characters that you have, and I thought, at the beginning of the book, we start with kind of portraits of each of them, alternating chapters. And each of them, you talk about the kind of the places where they go and what that means to them. And they all have kind of a darkness in them, each one of them, or the experiences that you choose.
They have a sense of being isolated, or they have a gap somewhere in them.
An emptiness.
An emptiness
that
more
they're
than
trying
a darkness.
To fill.
Yeah.
And maybe that's been you, you know,
or a
maybe.
Coolness or a chill, you know, or just, darkness is too strong because they don't really do anything dark, you know, but they sometimes fail to meet the challenges that life presents.
Although dark
them.
Things are happening. I think that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Dark things happen. Like the chapter about Dan, who's the boy who goes off to America.
Yeah.
And that's a really important scene in the book where he says, I'm going to be a priest. Mm-hmm. And that just messes everybody up. But he goes to America and eventually we learn that he is going to be gay.
Mm-hmm.
And the darkness is the period in the 80s during AIDS in New York, which I'm going to ask you to read a piece of. And then, but then for Constance, this older sister, her darkness is cancer, potentially.
Yeah, I suppose. The body is, immortality is a challenge to all of them, I suppose. But I think Constance is always looking after people, and you have to wonder about why she's so good as well. I mean, what she's trying to fill. There are a lot of biscuits also involved as Constance tries to fill some little, gap.
But she's, of all of them, she's probably the happiest.
She has the smallest life, and she is the most satisfied with her life.
Yeah. But then Emmett is pretty unhappy.
I don't know if Emmett is unhappy. He becomes the priest in a way that Dan failed to become.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
And he goes off. Dan was going to go off on the missions, but Emmett goes off to the developing world to become an aid worker. And it's a very Irish thing to do. If there's a famine or a disaster, you go, and these agencies, there's always Irish people involved.
Yeah,
in
that's
it.
True.
It's so I was interested in this as a kind of shadow tradition that we don't really see much of. But Emmett has, he's been through war and famine and all the rest of it, and he's suffering a little from compassion fatigue. If he ever was very compassionate, he is very idealistic, I think, when he started out. But at this stage, and when we hit him when we come to him in the book, he's it's all catching up with them. I mean, their problem, whatever it is, catches up with them.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Right. And definitely for Hannah, who's kind of suffering a lot.
Yes. Well, Hannah is suffering. Yes, she is. She starts out charming. We start with her 12-year-old gaze, and she's the one who introduces us to all the family. She's this kind of tranced 12-year-old, very particular gaze. She sees things in a very clear way, things she doesn't understand. And yes, she is she goes off to be an actress. All the lives I didn't lead. Yeah. But Hannah drinks too much, and I felt sorry for her as an author, but there's nothing you can do with a character who drinks too much because they can't develop until they stop drinking too much. So it's one of those things, if you add drugs or drink to a character, that their development stops for that time.
Right. And also, you weren't interested. This book is not about how to save her, I don't think.
No, I mean, but there are moments of grace, I hope.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't think that she's lost in any way.
But she scared me.
Did she?
Yeah, I think the scene that I thought was absolutely brilliant was her lying. She's drunk and has fallen down. The baby's asleep and she cuts her head and there's blood. And it's kind of that's a trance moment. But that was kind of scary.
Yeah. I suppose, with a baby in the house. Yeah, that's not great.
You worry. I think I'm more worried about her than about anybody else. Because you think about...
But they each have a role within the family. And if you look actually in the texture of the prose, Hannah is always getting dumped on and shamed in some way or another. Yeah. Her bedroom's a mess,
She's the youngest, right?
She's the youngest, yeah. So she's that's the role she plays in the family. If anyone's cross, they turn the cross with Hannah. She gets it all. I hope lightly done, but you would notice it maybe on a second reading that's what's going on. But also she has a young baby, and whatever was missing for her becomes radically important, and the right. absence is there. It's, you know, but you know, the baby stops crying. That's the thing that babies do. They stop, I mean, around 22 or 23, they stop crying 17 times a day. And, you know, and change happens. Change happens. Right.
Well, she seems to be in that way. She's the only one who actually is able to be in love. Because she's in love with her baby. Everybody else says.
Well, no, Constance is in love. Constance loves her husband, loves her children.
I'm not sure, but in love. I thought.
Oh, in the romantic
in
sense,
love,
yeah.
Yeah, it didn't seem like. I mean, Constance was pretty solidly happy and satisfied, but not in love.
Huh.
And even she tried to have an affair and it didn't work.
Just briefly.
Yeah.
But, well, no, she just didn't find it exciting.
Right. But, but Dan.
I mean, if Hannah had an affair, my goodness.
Right.
There would be no doubt. Yeah.
Right.
But it would be catastrophe.
But Dan can't be in love. You have him pretty much unable to be that person.
Yeah.
I don't think that's bad. I'm just saying that
until close to the end, you know. I mean, everyone is getting glimmers towards the end.
Yeah. Well, because the novel, again, not wanting to give away story, but the novel does come to a reconciliation, let's say.
Yeah, kind of crisis and catharsis and reconciliation. Yeah. And
things change.
And things change. And I hope there's a sense of dawn in the book. Not to give people too grim a picture, you know. but there's love there too.
Well, it's funny though. You talked about the grimness. Some writers write talking about the grimness of the western part of Ireland, whereas other people see the beauty there. And so you both things can exist. They can exist in the story about a family as much as, you know, the rocks and the light in the land itself.
It's a harsh beauty there. It's a harsh beauty. Yeah.
So do you want to a big section of the book takes place in New York, and I think it would be wonderful if you could read a piece from that part.
I could indeed, David. And this is a piece. Dan temporarily leaves the book. He doesn't just leave little old Ireland, which is kind of little and old in 1980. It's just before all the changes kicked in. And he goes to a really different New York and the kind of place he could never have imagined anyway. And
the narrative voice in this section I thought was really interesting because
it's a we.
It's a we. It's completely different.
Yeah.
And I don't ever really know who the we is. It's sort of like a generalized group of people who are all friends.
Yeah.
And you're talking about
all connected.
Yeah.
And I wanted to respect the fact that so many of the individual voices in this subculture of gay life in the East Village in New York died, so that the I was not a.
It was almost like the.
Not a stable thing.
Right. It's almost like the we in an old play, you know.
Yeah, in a Greek chorus. Yeah. Okay. I think Dan, Dan, we find out, is at this dinner party. We're following two characters called Billy and Greg, who kind of fancy each other. Well, Greg fancies Billy anyway. Greg glanced at Billy as if to say, watch and learn. They're at a dinner party. They tried not to talk about the disease. They went through Twin Peaks. They talked about the art scene, what Larry was showing next, how money was wrecking the East Village now. And whatever happened to that guy who used to walk a tightrope and piss beautifully in an arc perfectly balanced into the East River? No, he pissed on the floor down in that club on 48th Street. Should have been the river. Whatever happened to him? Every name they spoke dragged in its own tiny silence after it. Gone quiet, alive. Arthur was positive for 6 years and he hadn't a thing wrong with him. People wanted to touch him. He was so old now. Arthur remembered things no one else remembered. Who could keep all that? Who could hold on to it? His head was a museum. And when he died, the museum would be empty. The museum would fall down. Greg read nothing but the classics now, tender of his eyesight and of his time. He talked about Achilles' dream of the dead Patroclus, how the dead man would not touch him but only boss him about when all Achilles wanted was to feel the guy in his arms. Why was that? That the dead have voices in our dreams but no density. It's just this huge sense of themness. It's all meaning and no words. Because words are also physical, don't you think, the way they touch you. Sometimes they do. Use words, I mean, said Arthur. My tree is all hibiscus. Someone said that to me once. No one asked who. It's a war, Massimo said. Greg said, fuck that, he never signed up for any damn war. He wanted a civilian's death, he said, a personal death. He wanted a death he could call his own. Massimo said Gabriel Torres was working out in the Y on West 23rd, and the stir as he wiped down one machine and went to the next. Gabriel Torres was the most beautiful man you have ever seen. Where he gets the time, said Arthur. You know, he was the doctor. He was the doctor down in Simpkins. You know, Greg, sometimes I think we'd all be better off with a woman in sensible shoes. Dan's face through all of this was a thing of quiet attention. His pale skin soaked up the candlelight, and he listened so well it seemed the whole table was talking just for him. Greg lifted a glass and said, look at those cheekbones. And Dan gave a smile. The poet, that Irish poet, Yeats, said Arthur, on which, to everyone's amazement and delight, Dan opened his mouth and a ream of poetry fell out. Line after line, it was like a scroll unfurling along the tabletop, a carpet unrolled. And each of us, as we heard it, realised where we were and who was with us. We saw our shadows shifting on the back wall, the office cleaner across the way in trembling fluorescent tinged with green, the dark city brown of the sky. Dan finished, placed a hand to his chest and inclined his head. There was applause. Alex told him he had a voice like wild honey. And a face, said Massimo, like some portrait with a red hat. What was that one in the Palazzo Pitti? Some cardinal, anyway, in a red hat. Dan said, don't fucking cardinal me, whatever else you do. And we all laughed. And then we looked at him, that mixture of shyness and blurting arrogance. He was quite the thing, we thought. And we also thought about his freckled white skin with the blue veins under it and about his uncut Irish cock.
Beautiful. That was great. So of the characters in the book, because I won't get a chance to really talk about all of them in as much detail, which one really captivated you the most when you were writing?
I love them all equally, unlike their mother. Unlike their mother.
Well, you're their true mother.
When you're writing, I mean, I spent a lot of time with these people one way or the other. And I started off with Emmett. I was interested in the whole business of compassion. I was interested in that coolness he had and that idealism. And I was interested in that kind of brain that he had. And Constance was the hardest one for me to write. I was most impatient with her because she didn't want to get out, really. I mean, she had vague yearnings for America. But mostly my women characters, if they have, you know, they have small children, they're in a small, I mean, not small, but they're living a very ordinary life. If I have a woman character living a very ordinary life, I want her to kick some ass, you know, and I want her to, by writing her voice, I'm freeing her up. But Constance didn't want to be freed up. Constance was kind of happy where she was. So I really had to give in to that. And that took a lot of writing.
Yeah. So she was more complicated for you.
For me personally, yeah. As a human being, she was more complicated.
Because maybe because she is the least like you?
No, she has the life that's most like mine. But our minds are quite different.
And you don't want to be her, I don't think.
Well, she's the happiest of the lot of them. I don't know if I want to be any of the other ones either.
Well, no, that's true. But anyway, we're sort of going off on other things. But, you know, it's interesting to me the way you broke the kind of narrative frame in this book. You know, instead of having literally a beginning, middle, and end, I think it's much more, it's more complicated than that. And I like that. Mm-hmm. And did you think about when you were writing that, was, you know, how did it come in that way? Did you think of story?
I think I was working on it for about a year, and then a kind of structural announcement was made to me about how it should go. I had set out to write a female King Lear at one stage, and then so I realized that I was going to do a prequel, really, that all the children of Lear were going to get their full story before they, as it were, walked on stage. So there's four very separate sections, and then Rosaline, the mother, writes a Christmas card to all of them, calling them home, and then they walk on for what is essentially a play in the second half, because they know each other so well. I mean, no, the reader knows them so well,
right,
that all they have to do is talk now, and that freight of knowledge,
right, which is sort behind of the words, mimicking what is true for them, which is that they come back to this place. I mean, Constance doesn't leave, but they are all in this place, which they know really well. It becomes instantly home, despite the fact that they've been away for years and years.
And they lapse into old habits, and you know, the girls make the tea. And but they don't fight or anything. People are eternally accusing me of having dysfunctional families in my work, but they're all there at Christmas and they get on fine and nobody stomps off except Rosaline. They get on well enough.
Right.
They just have a bigger life than the one that's in the room.
Right. And in some ways, this is what you were talking about, compassion. Mm. It's only compassion that saves them at that point, in a way.
Well, they have a small, their loss becomes evident in the book, and then they regain something.
Yeah. So do you want to read another little
piece? I will. I'll read Rosaline off on her walk after Christmas dinner. Rosaline's getting a bit old, and perhaps the brain isn't what it used to be, but this is up on the Green Road.
Rosaline's 80, that's right?
She's 76.
76, sorry.
She got in her little car and drove away from the lot of them. The big faces on them, she left them to it. Such selfish children she had reared. She left them to get on with it, whatever it was, their lives. And she came out to walk off her dinner and take in the sharpness of the air inside herself to get the sea air. Anyway, she drives in her little car to the edge of Ireland and gets out. The sea was huge for her. The light, gentle and great. The fields, indifferent, as she walked up the last of the hill. But she got a slightly sarcastic feel off the ditches. There was no other word for it. Sprinkles of derision, like the countryside was laughing at her. Presences. At the gate beyond the last house, where the tarmac road turned into a green road and the sheepdog turned for home, she looked back on the valley of Oot Dara. Solemn and dark now, with the flaggy shore at the sea edge of it, graves and dolmens there, and ancient roads and gateways to nothing, from nothing. A couple of houses were lit up for Christmas, the blink of the lights a glimmering from this distance. There was a little ruined church down in that place, with a curse in the name of it, with a curse in the name of the man who built it, too terrible to speak aloud. This she knew from Pat Madigan, who took her walking along these uplands with her little dog in the summer of 1956. He talked more in those days and weeks than he ever did after, about curses and the like, pishogues, the fairies on the mound of Crochetihon, and the people lost in the scrubby, treacherous ground below it. He talked about the foxes behind Knockawn's mountain, the 17 ancient forts between here and Sliabh Elva, and the goats that lived in the hazel scrub. He told her the depth and beauty of the cave called Powell na Gcrí, the two Englishmen who went down it with ropes and lamps. He pointed to the place where the three townlands met, Oot Dara, Ballinahown and Crumlin, a gap in the cliff that belonged to none of them called Laba na Héan Vó, the bed of the one cow. There was a story, he said, about that cow and the end of the world. Then he laughed and told her about a heifer he had once who came into heat with her head stuck in a big bucket, a tub almost made out of blue metal. The handle was up over her poll, whatever way she managed it, and the bull was working her, the pair of them, walking the field with the bucket swinging and banging until she came into a standing heat and he mounted her. And the sound out of her then, he said, I'm surprised she didn't deafen herself in the bucket. There was no stopping him. He pointed to a house where a man killed himself by hanging. And a rock overlooking the sea where the ghost of a hungry man was said to sit, turning to stare at passers-by. He talked of a place that was miles away, where a woman kept her daughter chained in the henhouse, and a woman whose house was full of money sent to her by her sons in America. He said there were babies born in one house that never saw the light of day. He said the women of one family in particular took their babies back into themselves as a cat did their kittens. And it was important always to marry out in a place like this if he got the chance. And she was his chance. He did not say that he loved her. He said that if she would have him, a fine woman like her, unencumbered and free, with her own money and no one to stop her, if she would make her choice and choose him, that he would worship her with his body and with his entire soul until the day he died. Foolish, but true. That is what he said. And that is the way he saw the land, with no difference between the different kinds of yesterday, no difference between a man and his ghost, between a real heifer and a cow that was waiting for the end of the world. It was all just a way of talking. It was a rise and fall in the telling, a rounding out before the finish, a flourish, a shiver. And it was for her. He had saved every detail up for her alone, as though every rock and tree awaited her coming for its explication. And when she laughed at him, he only agreed with her. "If I am a fool," he said, "then let me be a great fool and not a small one." There was no turning him down. And when he entered her that first time and every time subsequent, it was a sacred kind of pleasure he took. She was sure of it. My own Rosaline. Pat Madigan worshipped her. And he did not tell a lie. He wanted her for the money she had, for the fine house and the children he could get out of her. He laughed at her talk, and then he ignored her talk. But there were times, even in his last days, even at the very end, when he looked at her with a pride so keen it was almost sinful. My virgin flower, my flower of flowers. Somewhere along here, that is where the first kiss happened between them, her little dog sitting down for them to finish, looking out to sea. She had married beneath her. Even the dog seemed to indicate it by the indifferent set of her head. My life of life, my saint of saints, my dark Rosaline. And ha, she said, because she'd had the pleasure of Pat Madigan for 40 years. And ha! Because he was dead and she was still alive up here on the green road. Years since she had been kissed on the mouth. Years.
Fantastic. I definitely would like to listen to you read this whole book. I hope you will, you know, do an audio version of it because it's great. And one of the things...
It's a bit of fun.
No, I was going to ask you, you know, the for an American, some of the place names, I don't know how to pronounce them.
I know.
So it was, you know, that's really good to hear you do that. But I wanted to ask you, though, because so much of the book takes place in... Ardivin. See, I didn't even know how to pronounce
that. I'm sorry about this. But I think people like a bit of sort of swishy. I mean, it's just true. Ardivin means beautiful height.
Okay.
In Irish.
Oh, and then there's that great, and I think there was the, there's a poem about Rosaline.
Yeah, my dark Rosaline, do not sigh, do not weep. The priests are on the ocean green, they plough along the deep. It's by James Clarence Mangan, and Rosaline is a figure of Ireland in that poem. But there's also another little poem, which is O Little Kirk of Baskin. The wild, the bleak, the fair, the O little stony pastures whose flowers are sweet if rare. O rough, the rude Atlantic, the thunderous, the wide, whose kiss is like a soldier's kiss that cannot be denied. All night long we dream of you and waking, think we're there. Vain dream and foolish waking, we never shall see Claire.
I think that's probably the perfect place for us to end. I really want to thank you so much. It was really fun for me to talk to you about this book and to hear
you. Thank you so much.
It was great. I loved it.
Great.
Thank you
had
so much.
A bit
much.
Of fun. Thanks.
This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've had the really great pleasure of talking to Anne Enright. Her new book is called The Green Road. It's May 2015. She's traveling around and promoting the book. So if you get the chance, go see her, go listen to her. It's really fun.